Maybe some things are best kept to ourselves. The exchange was unprecedented in our friendship. But then again, so was the feeling that she questioned the character of my only child, her own godson. For some reason, that was easier to focus on than the fact that I was wondering about his character, too.
Okay, she said,
her voice softer, but not at all remorseful. I told her I had to go, then thanked her for her advice.
You're welcome, she said.
Anytime.
Chapter 9. Tom. On Monday evening, as I was cleaning up the dinner dishes, I got a call from a blocked number. Something told me I should answer it, and I listened to a man's voice I didn't recognize say, "Hello, is this Tom Volpe?" "Yes, this is Tom," I said, stopping in my tracks. "Hi, Tom," the man said. "This is Kirk Browning, Finch's father." For a second, I couldn't speak. "Hello," he said, "are you there?" "Yeah, I'm here. What can I do for you?" I said, my fist clenched as I gripped the phone with my other hand. His reply was slick and fast. "It's not what you can do for me. I want to do something for you. I want to try to repair what my son has done." "Huh," I said. "I'm really not sure that's going to be possible." "Yes, I realize that may be the case," he said. "But I was wondering if there's any way we could get together and talk." My instinct was to say no. There was nothing he could say to me, and I had less than nothing to say to him. But then I told myself there actually was a lot I wanted to tell this man. "Yeah, okay," I said. "When?" "Well, let's see. I'm out of town at the moment. Back on Wednesday morning. Does Wednesday night work? My house around 6? No, that actually won't work for me. I'm with my daughter in the evenings," I said to make a point. "Well, you tell me when," he replied, which is what he should have said in the first place. "Wednesday at noon," I said, hoping it wasn't at all convenient for him, that he might even have to get on an earlier flight. He hesitated, then said, "Sure, that works. I land at 11. Can we say 12:30 just to be safe?" "Fine," I said. "Great. Can I give you my address?" "Yeah. Just text it to me. And this time, don't block your number." Living in a city like Nashville my whole life, I'd seen plenty of impressive homes, and I knew by the Browning's Bellmead address that their house was going to be very nice. But I was still blown away when I pulled down their long driveway past the tall hedges and got a load of that brick and stone English Tudor mansion in a downright fairy tale setting. I'm a big fan of older homes, and I couldn't help but admire the architectural details of this one. The steeply pitched slate roof with cross gables, the half-timbered exposed framing, the tall, narrow windows, stained and leaded. I got out of my car, closed the door, and walked toward the mammoth double front doors, made of mahogany, elaborately carved and flanked by flickering lanterns. I shuddered to think what their gas bill must be, let alone their mortgage, then reminded myself that people like this probably didn't have mortgages. I approached the front porch, trying to pinpoint exactly what I was feeling. I was still just as pissed as I'd been on the drive over, but now I was feeling something else, too. Was I intimidated? No. Was I jealous? Not at all. Did I begrudge them their fortune? I really didn't think so. My problem, I decided as I eyed the doorbell, was that it was just so predictable that the rich boy did the shitty thing to the poor girl. And I hated being part of that cliché. Frankly, I was also extra angered by his asshole father's staggering lack of self-awareness. Who but a total clueless idiot would ask a stranger to meet at his own home if it looked like this? Especially if his jackass kid was in the wrong. Had he done any research on Lila or me whatsoever? Did he have any idea that she was one of the few kids at Windsor on financial aid? It would have taken him about 10 seconds on Google to discover that I was a carpenter, the kind he'd probably hire than nickel and dime to death, which meant either he hadn't bothered or he had looked me up and didn't give a shit what I'd be feeling. I wasn't sure which was worse, but I hated him more by the second. With a heavy chip weighing down my shoulder, I pushed the doorbell, listening to the formal chime echo inside. At least 30 seconds passed, during which I reminded myself that all these people had on us was money. I had all the moral high ground and the leverage that came with it. Finally, the door opened, and there stood an older Latina woman who told me to please come in. She'd get Mr. Browning. The whole scene was so classic, especially when Mr. Browning immediately materialized behind her. Clearly, he could have gotten to his own door first, but he wanted his brown housekeeper to open it for him. Look important at any and all costs was, I'm sure, one of his rules to live by. Then, without thanking her or introducing her, he sort of pushed past her and filled the doorway. I hated everything about his appearance, his ruddy complexion, like he'd just been drinking on a golf course, his gelled hair, too dark to be his real color, his pink linen shirt, unbuttoned 2 buttons too low. "Hi there, Tom," he said, reaching out to shake my hand, his booming frat boy voice matching his foolishly firm grip. "Kirk Browning, please come in." I nodded, then forced myself to say hello as he stepped inside to let me in. I glanced around the foyer, surprised by the cool contemporary decor. A gigantic pale blue abstract painting hung over a black lacquered chest. It wasn't my usual taste, but I had to admit it was pretty stunning. "Thanks so much for coming," Kirk said, downright beaming. "Shall we go chat in my office?" "That's fine," I said. He nodded, leading me through a formal living room, down a wide corridor, and into a dark wood-paneled office decorated with mounted deer and fowl, yet another radical design departure. "Welcome to my man cave," he said with a chuckle. I gave him a tight-lipped smile as he gestured toward a fully stocked bar cart. "Too early in the day for scotch? It's 5 o'clock somewhere, right?" "No, thanks," I said. "But you go right ahead." He hesitated, as if seriously contemplating a solo drink, but decided against it. He then gestured toward a couple of armchairs floating in the middle of the room. I had the feeling they were freshly staged, and it gave me the creeps. "Please," he said, "have a seat." I chose the chair with a view toward the doorway, my back to the gas fireplace. Of course the pussy wasn't going to burn real logs, I thought, as he sat down, planting his feet perfectly parallel to each other. His pant legs came up enough to reveal bare ankles. No socks, with fancy loafers. Typical Belle Meade. "So, thanks for coming over, Tom," he said, exaggerating the pronunciation of my name with a low hum. I nodded but said nothing, determined not to make this easy for him. "I hope it's not interrupting your work day too much." I shrugged and said, "I'm flexible, self-employed." "Ah," he said. "And what is it that you do, Tom?" "I'm a carpenter," I said. "Oh, wow, that's great," he said, his voice and expression oozing condescension. "They say the happiest people work with their hands. I wish I were more handy." He looked down at his open palms, which were undoubtedly as soft as they were useless. I have trouble changing light bulbs. I resisted the urge to ask him how many people he had on staff to do that for him, then figured, what the hell? You must have a guy for that, I asked. He was taken aback for a beat, but quickly recovered. Actually, my wife Nina is good at that stuff, believe it or not. I raised my brow. At changing light bulbs? Ha, no. I mean, all sorts of mini home projects. She enjoys them. But yes, for the more complicated ones, we do have a handyman. Great guy, Larry. He said, as if all us manual laborers knew one another. I glanced around the room and said, so, where is your wife? Will she be joining us? He shook his head and said, unfortunately, she had a prior engagement. That is unfortunate, I deadpanned. Yes, he said, but I thought it might actually be better if we could talk, you know, man to man. Right. Man to man, I echoed. So, Tom, he said after taking a deep breath, let me begin by apologizing on behalf of my son. The photo he took of your daughter was absolutely inexcusable. I squinted, pretending to be confused, cueing more babble. It was terrible, and believe me, Finch understands that now. Now? I asked. So he didn't understand that before, when he posted it? Well, Kirk said, holding up his hands, now palms out. To be clear, he didn't actually post anything. Oh, pardon me, I said, an expression I never used. He didn't understand that it was wrong when he sent the photo to his buddies? There was no way he could answer this question in the negative, I thought. But sure enough, he did. No, he said. Not at first. He wasn't thinking at all. You know teenage boys. But now he gets it. Now he sees completely. And he's sorry. Very, very sorry. Has he told Lila that? I asked, feeling sure I knew the answer. Well, not yet. He wants to. But I told him to wait until I talk to you. I wanted to apologize to you first. I cleared my throat and chose my words carefully. Well, Kirk, I said, I appreciate the apology. I do. But unfortunately, it doesn't undo what your son... I'm sorry. What's his name again? Finch, he said, nodding, his chin nearly reaching his chest. His name is Finch. Ah, yes, that's right. As in Atticus Finch? I asked. Yes, indeed, he grinned. To Kill a Mockingbird is my wife's favorite book. Huh, mine too. Imagine that, I said, uncrossing my arms before slapping my thigh in a sarcastic way. Wow, what a coincidence, I'll tell her, he said, smiling. So, where were we? We were talking about what your son did to my daughter, Lila. Yes, and I can't tell you how sorry Finch is. Try, I said, forcing a fake smile. How sorry? Oh, very. He's very, very sorry. He's a wreck. He hasn't been able to eat or sleep. I interrupted with a brittle laugh, feeling myself start to lose my composure. So, wait, are you, do you, am I supposed to feel sorry for your son? No, no, not at all. I didn't mean that, Tom. I just meant that he understands that what he did was wrong, and he's extremely sorry. But he didn't mean the caption the way it sounded. He just meant it as a joke. Does your son often make racist jokes? Of course not, he said, finally starting to squirm. Is your daughter even Hispanic? No. His face lit up. I knew it, he said, as if the case were now closed. Her mother's Brazilian. His smile faded into a look of confusion as I continued. So, technically, I think the word you're looking for is Latina. Hispanic is a demonym that only includes Spaniards and other speakers of the Spanish language. And as I'm sure you know, the language of Brazil is Portuguese. It was all information Lila had fed me in recent months, research she had done to try to understand exactly who she was. Very interesting, he said, as I got the feeling he was either patronizing me or searching for a good angle for his kid. So, Brazilians aren't a different race? Brazilians can be any race, Kirk, I said slowly, like I was talking to an idiot, which I was. Just like Americans. Oh, sure, right, he said. That makes sense. So, Lila's white. Mostly, I said, unwilling to dignify this man with a breakdown of her lineage. I wasn't even sure exactly what it was, other than Beatriz's mother was a Portuguese-Brazilian and all white, while her father was something like a quarter black, which I guess made Lila 1/16th African-Brazilian. Mostly, Kirk asked. Look, bottom line, although Lila's mother did at one point have a green card, Lila is 100% American, I said. That's wonderful, he said. Just wonderful. Which part? I asked. All of it, he said. That her mother came here, that Windsor has this kind of diversity. I actually don't think it's all that diverse. But it is a great school. I've been very impressed with the academics and the headmaster, I said purposefully. Kirk nodded. Yes. Walt's very good at what he does, and I recognize that he's in a tough position now, with this incident, and I think for everyone's sake, he's hoping we handle it privately. Privately? I asked, knowing exactly where this was going. Yes, between the two families. I can assure you that Finch is being severely punished, and we would like to compensate you both for your time from work, and also any distress this may have caused you and your daughter. I stared at him in disbelief as he walked over to his desk, opened a drawer, and pulled out a white business-size envelope. As he returned to hand it to me, I could see my name written on it, and I was overcome with a fight-or-flight feeling. Should I punch this guy in the face, or should I take the money and run? At the very least, I wanted to know how much this joker thought it would take to buy us off. Maybe he had done his research after all and already knew I was a carpenter. Maybe he even assumed I was a Hispanic carpenter. Maybe he had multiple envelopes in his desk. Envelope number one for the minority laborer. Envelope number two for the blue-collar white guy. Envelope three for a fellow suit. Fight or flight? Flight or fight? Wasn't it supposed to be an instinct, not a choice? In any event, I decided to flee, standing to take the envelope from him. As I put it in my back pocket, I could tell it contained bills, a lot of bills. A look of palpable relief crossed Kirk's face. I'm really glad we could have this talk, Tom, he said. I think it's been very, very constructive. Yes, I said. It really has. And if you'd just let Walt know that we settled this? His voice trailed off, as I guess even he wasn't brazen enough to actually spell it out. I'm paying you off. In the ultimate head fake, I nodded, smiled, then allowed myself to be cheerfully shown to the door.
Chapter 6. Chapter 10. Nina. Kirk returned home from the airport only 30 minutes before his scheduled meeting with Lala's father. As he unpacked his roller bag, moving back and forth between his closet and our bathroom, I tried to engage him in conversation. I asked him what he planned to say to Thomas Volpe, and if he was sure he didn't want me to join them. To my guilty relief, he said he was quite sure, then added he'd rather not discuss the details.
"I don't want to sound too rehearsed," he said. "It needs to be natural."
I nodded, not quite buying it, but once again relieved. A few minutes later, I left the house in a low-key panic. As I tried to distract myself with mindless errands, I thought a lot about my husband. How what I'd once loved most about him was now what frustrated me to no end. He had to be right. He had to be in charge. But in our earlier years, I was occasionally the exception to the rule. I could persuade him when nobody else could. At the very least, we had once been a partnership. Equals. I thought of an earlier childhood crisis, when Finch and another boy had dipped the ears of a neighbor's Cocker Spaniel puppy in blue paint. He'd denied it, despite overwhelming proof to the contrary, including the blue paint I'd found on the treads of his small Nike sneakers. Kirk and I had argued about how to handle it. He was in favor of brute force to extract a confession, but I'd convinced him to let me try my way first. The three of us sat at the kitchen table together as I told Finch we would always love him, no matter what, and how important it was to tell the truth.
"I did it, Mommy," Finch finally said, breaking down in tears. "I'm so sorry."
I still remember the way Kirk looked at me, the way we later made love, and he told me that he'd picked the most wonderful mother for his son. It had been a long time since he looked at me like that. About an hour later, as I was still running errands, Kirk called, asking if I wanted to meet him for lunch. "Oh, no. Was it that bad?" I said, thinking that Kirk never had time for lunch, at least not a lunch without a business purpose.
"No, it wasn't bad at all. It went great, actually," he said,
his voice notably chipper.
"Really?"
I said.
"Yeah. We had a good talk. I like him."
"And did he like you?"
"Of course," Kirk said with a laugh. "What's not to like?"
I ignored his question and asked for more details.
"I'll tell you everything over lunch. Meet me at the club," he said,
referring to Belle Mead, the country club to which we belonged, and his family always had.
"Can we go somewhere else?" I said,
remembering how I'd felt about the club when I first started to go with Kirk and his family. It had made me uncomfortable. The fawning staff in their stiff white jackets, the formal rooms filled with oriental rugs and antique furniture, and most of all, the lily-white membership. There were no black members at all until 2012, and almost all the staff were people of color. Though to be fair, and as Kirk had pointed out, plenty of African-Americans had been approached to join, but had simply declined.
I couldn't say I blamed them.
Somewhere along the line, though, I had succumbed to the luxury, focusing less on the exclusivity and more on the beauty and serenity and utter convenience of our membership. It was a rare week that I didn't spend at least a few hours there, whether playing tennis, meeting Finch and Kirk at the casual grill for dinner, or having drinks with my friends on the veranda overlooking the golf course.
"Do you have something against the club now?" Kirk said, as if reading my mind.
"Nothing," I said. "I'm just not in the mood to talk to people, given everything."
"Okay," he said,
acquiescing faster than I'd thought he would.
"Want me to call Edge or Husk?"
The likelihood of running into someone I knew was pretty high at those restaurants, too. But I didn't want to be too difficult. Besides, I loved Husk. It was probably my favorite restaurant in the city. So I told Kirk I would meet him there.
"Great," he said. "See you soon."
20 minutes later, Kirk and I were seated at a cozy table on the art-lined lower level of the restaurant, set in a 19th-century home in Rutledge Hill. He still hadn't told me what happened, keeping me in total suspense, insisting that we have a glass of wine first.
I was annoyed but hopeful, as we chatted with a waitress we'd had several times before, then put in our order for a burger, him, and shrimp and grits, me, as well as one glass of wine to split. As soon as she departed, I said, "All right, could you please tell me now, Kirk?" He nodded, then took a deep breath. "So, he got to the house right after you left. We went to my office and made a little small talk. Then we got into everything. At first he was a little touchy, but then I just gave it to him straight."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning, I told him how sorry Finch is. How sorry we are, too."
"And what did he say?"
"Honestly, not too much. He was pretty quiet. But I think he agrees that we can handle this privately."
"He does?" I said, more than a little surprised.
"Yes."
"Meaning he doesn't want it to go before the Honor Council?" I asked.
"Correct," Kirk said as the waitress brought two rolls to the table. He began to butter one of them, looking smug.
"But how? Why?" I said. "He just agreed with you?"
"Well, let's just say I gave him a little incentive."
I stared at him, my heart sinking. "What kind of incentive?"
"A financial one," he said with a shrug.
"What?" I said.
"What do you mean, what? I just gave him a little cash," he said, stone-faced. "No big deal."
"Oh, my God! How much did you give him?" I asked.
He shrugged again, then mumbled, $15,000. I shook my head and let out a whimper.
"Please, please tell me you're kidding."
"Oh, come on, Nina," he said, his expression confirming that this was no joke. "You don't think our son's future is worth 15 grand?
"It's not the amount," I said. "If we're just discussing the amount, I'd question the lowball."
"15,000 is a lot to the average person," he interjected, always a man of the people when it was convenient to his narrative.
"And this guy's a carpenter." "That's not the point," I shouted. I glanced around, reconfirming that we didn't know anyone seated in the galley area, but still lowered my voice. "The point is, you gave him hush money."
He rolled his eyes and gave me a condescending smirk. "This isn't a gangster movie, Nina. It's not hush money. I'm not asking him to be quiet about anything."
"Then what's the point?"
"Well, for one, it's a token of our apology. For another, it's an incentive."
"An incentive to do what?"
"An incentive to tell Walt he doesn't want this thing to move forward to the Honor Council."
"Did you actually tell him that?" I asked, my disapproval growing by the second.
"Didn't have to. It was understood," he said. "Look, Nina, the guy willfully and gladly took the cash."
"You gave him $15,000 in cash?"
"Yes, and again, he took it. It was a meeting of the minds, for sure. A contract."
I pressed my lips together, thinking. There was so much wrong with what he was telling me, I wasn't sure where to start. "What about Finch?" I said. "Are you going to tell him about this little contract?" I said.
"I wasn't planning on it," he replied. "I think it's better if we leave Finch out of this."
"Leave out the person who single-handedly caused all the harm?"
"We're leaving him out of the solution, not the punishment. He is being punished, Nina, remember?"
"Okay, but what if it gets out? What if Finch finds out his father did something shady?" I asked. "And his mother went along with it?"
He shook his head. "No way. This guy's not going to talk. Think about it this way. When you slide someone a 50 to get a table at a restaurant, do they make an announcement?"
"No,
they don't, because it's shady on both sides."
"So you do admit you're being shady?"
He shrugged. "You want me to admit that? Sure, I'll admit that. It was a little shady, but I did it for a good cause. I did it for Finch, and it worked."
"How do you know it worked?" I said.
"Because he took the money, Nina. And before that, he was giving me an immigration lecture on how Brazilians aren't Hispanic, and and that his daughter is an American, yada, yada. He has an attitude. But then I handed him that cash, and suddenly he was all cool, calm, and collected. So you tell me, Nina, did it work?
When I didn't reply, he answered his own question.
Yes, it did. And you can sit there and be self-righteous all you want, but deep down, you have to agree that it was worth it.
I stared back at him, my thoughts scattered and racing. A very small, guilty part of me was relieved that Lila's father had been complicit. Besides, what choice did I have? I couldn't make him give us the money back. Well, putting that aside, I really think it's high time that Finch apologizes to Lila, face to face, I said as the waitress poured our glass of wine. I paused as Kirk tasted it and okayed it, then resumed when she left. And I would also like for the three of us to sit down again and talk a bit more in depth about everything. He's been avoiding me for 2 days, for longer than that, really, and I can't tell if he's sorry or pouting, I said, getting a little bit choked up. I can't tell what's in his heart right now.
He's sorry, Nina, and you know he has a good heart. We'll get through this, I promise.
I started to say that I thought I knew Finch's heart. But Julie was right. The sweet kid I once knew could never have done this to a girl. To anyone. It just didn't make sense. But there was something so reassuring and strong about the way Kirk was looking at me that I just couldn't bring myself to argue with him. Instead, at least for the moment, I put my faith in my husband, believing that he was right. That the three of us would get through this somehow. That night, I tried to talk to Finch. Kirk and I both did, but he insisted that he had to study for a test. Could we talk tomorrow? We relented, and then Kirk went to bed early, declaring himself exhausted. I tried to do the same, but I found myself lying in bed next to him, wide awake and more anxious than ever. Around midnight, I got up and went to my office and pulled the Windsor directory from a desk drawer. I flipped to the end of the alphabet and found the entry for Lila and Thomas Volpe. No mother was listed, unlike most divorce families with dual entries, and the only explanation I could think of was that she had died. I hope not recently. Then again, I would have wanted Lila to have as many years with her mother as possible. Feeling increasingly melancholy, I scanned down to read their address. They lived on Avondale Drive, a street that didn't sound familiar, though I knew the 37206 zip code was in East Nashville, over the Cumberland River. I opened my laptop and typed it into Google Maps, seeing a street view of the small bungalow located in Laughlin Springs. From what I could tell of the blurry photo, the house sat up high on a narrow lot, stairs leading from the street to the front door. There was one small tree in the yard, and a few bushes planted along the house. After studying the picture from every angle, I typed the address into Zillow. I saw that Thomas Volpe had purchased the home in 2004 for $179,000. I felt a stab of sheepishness approaching shame, thinking of our own house, its price tag just under $4 million. From there, I pulled up our online Amex statement, cringing at what we'd spent over the last billing cycle. It was amazing how quickly things added up, a few hundred dollars at a time. This particular month, I was the most culpable of the three of us, but I did spot Finch's $1,000 charge at the Apple Store, a $200 charge at Imogen and Willie, and $150 at Pinewood Social, the night before Beau's party. I seem to recall a conversation about him needing a new phone, but couldn't remember if he'd asked me for permission or simply informed me of the purchase after the fact. I felt certain that he hadn't mentioned any shopping or dining otherwise. Not that we had any real rules around his spending. In fact, money was something Kirk and I seldom discussed with our son. 5 years ago, when the financial picture had changed, the analysis of what to spend became pretty simple in our family. The question wasn't, did we need it or could we afford it, but simply, did we want it? If the answer was yes, we typically got it. The result was that Finch didn't dwell on money
or think about it at all, really, and had no clue about budgeting or anything normal people, let alone those in actual need, went through. I told myself to stop going off on this mental tangent. What did money or material things have to do with any of this anyway? Nothing. Character has nothing to do with finances. And yet, I had the feeling Julie might say otherwise, especially if she knew about Kirk's bribe, which now seemed increasingly significant. What if Thomas actually needed the money? Did that change the analysis at all? Did it make Kirk's attempt to buy him off better or worse? I wasn't sure, so I decided to look for more evidence, biting my lip, logging onto Facebook, and typing in Thomas Volpe. Three of them came up, but none was local. I tried a more general Google search and once again found nothing that seemed to fit. I then searched for Lila, finding her on Facebook and Instagram, though both accounts were private. All I could see were her profile pictures, two different shots from the same summer day. It was clearly the same girl from Finch's photograph, but in these pictures she looked so happy, standing on a dock in a ruffled off-the-shoulder top and white shorts. She was a pretty girl with a slender figure and beautiful long hair. I thought about her mother again, wondering not only when, but how she had died. Then, looking back at the directory at Thomas Volpe's email address, I couldn't stand it another second. I took a deep breath and began typing. Dear Thomas, my name is Nina Browning. I'm Finch's mother. I know you met my husband today, and he shared with me a bit about your conversation. I'm not sure how you were feeling, but I believe that more needs to be said and done to make things right. I was wondering if you'd consider meeting me to talk. I really hope you say yes. More important, I hope Lila is doing okay, in spite of the horrible thing my son did to her. I'm thinking of you both. Sincerely, Nina. I quickly proofread, then sent it before I could change my mind or even tweak any of the wording. The swoosh sound filled my office, and for a second, I regretted making contact. For one, I knew Kirk would view it as a strategic blunder and an even greater betrayal of him and Finch. For another, and from a strictly practical standpoint, what was I going to say to this man if he agreed to meet with me? Just as I convinced myself it was a moot point because Thomas likely wouldn't write back, after all, he had taken Kirk's cash, his name popped onto my computer screen. My heart quickening with a mix of relief and dread, I went to my inbox, opened the email, and read, "Tomorrow, 3:30 p.m. at Bongo East, Tom." "That works," I typed, my hand shaking. "See you then." The following morning was nothing short of torture as I paced around the house, stared at the clock, and counted down the minutes until my appointment with Tom. At 11, I made myself go to a meditation class with one of my most zen instructors, but it did no good whatsoever. A jangled mass of nerves, I came home, showered, and blew out my hair. It came out a little too full and done, so I put it in a ponytail, then loosened a few strands around my face. I did my makeup with a light touch, skipping eyeliner altogether, then went to my closet to pick out an outfit. The transitional spring weather is always tricky, especially when it comes to footwear. It was too warm for boots, too chilly for sandals. Pumps felt too dressy, and flats stripped me of confidence, which I very much needed. I finally selected a simple nude wedge and a navy blue DVF wrap dress. I kept my jewelry simple with diamond studs and my wedding band, removing my showier engagement ring. I knew it was ridiculously superficial to focus so much on appearances at a time like this, editing such small details. But I also believed that first impressions matter, and I wanted to show him respect without being at all ostentatious. Overcompensating for Nashville traffic and my own tendency to run late, I arrived at Five Points 20 minutes early, finding one of only three parking spots in front of the small, standalone building housing the East End coffee shop. I'd never been inside before, but I'd passed it plenty of times and remembered Finch telling me that it was also known as Game Point. I could see why. On the back wall, simple wood and iron shelves were lined with more than 100 board games, many of them vintage, all available for patrons to play. Nearby, an older couple played Battleship. They looked to be newly dating, very happy. At other tables sat many solo customers, most with laptops or reading material. I got in a very short line, scanning a colorful chalkboard menu. I ordered a latte and a sweet potato white chocolate muffin that looked interesting, but that I knew I probably wouldn't eat because my stomach was in knots. I paid, dropping a dollar bill into a tip jar that read, "Afraid of change? Leave it here." Then stood to the side, waiting for a tattooed male barista to make my drink. Glancing around, I took note of the exposed HVAC lining in the industrial ceiling, the concrete floor painted evergreen, and the bright sunlight filtering through high glass block windows. The place was so mellow, a vibe unlike the Starbucks and juice bars in my neighborhood. When my latte was ready, I took it from the counter, along with the muffin they'd microwaved and put on a plate, and found a table against the wall close to the game corner. I sat in the chair facing the door, where I sipped my coffee and waited. At exactly 3:30, a man of average height and build walked in and glanced around. He looked slightly too young to have a teenager, but as his eyes rested on me, I felt sure that it was Tom Volpe. I did a half stand and mouthed his name. He was probably too far away to read my lips, but he clearly got the gist of my body language, because he nodded, lowered his head, and walked toward me. With brown hair a little on the longer side, a couple days of beard growth, and a strong jaw, he looked like a carpenter. A second later, he was standing at the edge of my table, looking right at me. I stood the whole way. "Tom?" I said.
"Yes,"
he said in a low, deep voice. He did not initiate a handshake, or a smile, or do any of the typical things people do when they meet. Yet there was nothing about him that seemed hostile. His demeanor was a small relief, but almost more unsettling than anger. It gave me no starting point. "Hi," I said, running my palms along the sides of my dress. "I'm Nina."
"Yes," he said.
His gaze was empty. "It's nice to meet you," I blurted out, instantly regretting it, as there was nothing nice about this moment, and we both knew it. But he let me off the hook, announcing that he was going to get a coffee, then turned abruptly and headed toward the cash register. I waited a few seconds before sitting down and looked over my shoulder, covertly studying him further. He appeared fit and athletic, or at least naturally strong. He was wearing faded blue jeans, an untucked gray Henley, and rugged boots that were hard to put in a category. They weren't country or Western, nor were they of the lug-sole workman variety, and they certainly weren't at all Euro or trendy, like the ones lining the shelves of Kirk's closet. I watched him pay, drop his change into the tip jar, and collect his coffee before heading back my way. I lowered my head and took a few deep breaths, still uncertain of exactly what I was going to say. A moment later, he was sitting across from me. I watched him flip the lid off his coffee with his thumb, then wave the steam away from the cup. As he met my gaze, my mind went blank. Why wasn't I better prepared? No wonder Kirk never trusted me to take important meetings alone. Tom spoke first, saving me, though I knew that wasn't his intention.
"You look familiar," he said, squinting a little. "Have we met before?"
"I don't think so," I said. "Maybe just from Windsor?"
"No, it's not that," he said, shaking his head. "I feel like it's something else, longer ago."
I bit my lip, starting to sweat, and wishing I hadn't worn silk. "I don't know. I'm not very good with faces. Sometimes I think I have that disorder."
"Which disorder is that?"
he said, with a slight tilt of his head.
The one where you don't pay attention?
I was pretty sure he'd just made a jab at me, implying that I was self-absorbed. But I was in no position to be defensive, so I simply said, "No, it's a real thing. Facial blindness, I think it's called. I'm pretty sure I have a touch of that. But anyway."
"Yes. Anyway," he echoed,
glancing down to put the lid back on his coffee. It took him a second to get it on, pressing it all around the perimeter, clearly in no rush whatsoever. He raised the cup to his lips and took a long sip before looking at me again. This time he didn't save me. "So," I finally said, "I'm not sure where to begin."
"I'm sorry, can't help you there," he said,
with the first real trace of animosity. "I know, I just, well, as I said in the email, I don't think my husband handled things with you the right way." Tom nodded, his light brown eyes somewhere between cool and loathing.
"Oh, you mean his attempt to buy me off?"
My stomach dropped. "Yes," I said, "that, among other things." It fleetingly occurred to me that Tom could have already deposited or spent the money, and then what would I be saying about him as well? But no, he had used the word attempt. Sure enough, he reached into his back pocket for his wallet, opened it, and pulled out a stack of crisp new bills. He slid the pile of cash across the table. I looked down and saw Benjamin Franklin's familiar grimace, feeling queasy as I tried to formulate a sentence. "For what it's worth, I can't believe he did this," I said, staring down at the money. "I mean, I know that he did give you this, but I had nothing to do with his decision. This isn't how I wanted to handle things."
"And how did you want to handle things?"
I told him I didn't know exactly. He winced, then took another sip of coffee.
"But you weren't in favor of bribery?" he asked.
"No," I said, completely flustered. "I had no idea he was going to give you this."
"Yep, $15,000, Tom said, glancing at the stack again, "and it's all there."
I looked down at it, shaking my head.
"So, what was he bribing me to do, exactly?"
"I don't know," I said, meeting his gaze again. He gave me an incredulous look that bordered on a smile.
"You don't know?"
I swallowed and made myself say what I really thought. "I believe that he was trying to motivate you to tell Walter Quarterman that you don't think Finch should go before the Windsor Honor Council."
"You mean bribe me?"
"Yes."
"And what do you think?"
"What do you mean?" I stammered.
"Do you think Finch should go before the Honor Council?"
I nodded. "Yes, I do, actually."
"Why?"
he fired back. "Because what he did was wrong. So wrong, and I think he needs to face some consequences."
"Such as?"
Tom pressed. "Well, I don't know. Whatever the school decides is right." Tom let out a caustic laugh. "What's funny?" I said, feeling a stab of indignation. "Couldn't he see how hard I was trying? Couldn't he cut me a break, just a small one?"
"Nothing's funny, believe me," he said,
his smile fading into another stony gaze. We stared at each other for a few seconds before he cleared his throat and said,
"I was just wondering, Nina, how much do you and your husband give to the school? Above and beyond tuition."
"What do you mean?" I asked, although it was perfectly clear what he was getting at.
"I mean, do you have any buildings named after you on Windsor's campus?"
"No," I said, "although we did have a conference room in the library named after us. And a fountain. Honestly, I don't see how that is relevant. Despite what Kirk tried to do, which is awful, Mr. Quarterman isn't like that."
"Isn't like what?"
"He's a good person. He's not going to make a decision here based on what we've given to the school," I said.
"Okay, look," Tom said, leaning over his coffee. his face close enough to mine for me to make out the flecks of gold in his beard.
Say what you want, but I know how the world works, and so apparently does your husband.
His voice was calm, but his eyes were angry as he pushed the pile of bills toward me.
Well, obviously my husband got it wrong this time, I said,
my voice shaking a little. I gestured toward the money, then finally got rid of it, sliding the bills into my purse. Tom refused to grant me the point and instead said,
Your son got into Princeton, am I correct?
Yes, I said.
Congratulations. You must be really proud.
I was, I said. But I'm not proud now. I'm ashamed of my son and my husband, and I'm just so sorry. He stared at me, then said,
Look, here's the way I see it. Your husband wanted to make this go away with money, and you're trying to do the same thing with words, with a nice apology. You recognize your husband's a bit of an asshole, so you're trying to clean up after him, and ditto for your son.
My cheeks on fire, I shook my head and said, No, that's not what I'm doing. I'm not here trying to clean anything up or make anything go away. I'm just here to tell you I'm sorry, because I am.
Okay, and?
And what? I said.
Does that make you feel better? Telling me that? Are you hoping that I'm going to tell you not to worry about it? No hard feelings. All's forgiven. And you're not like your husband and son?
His voice was stronger now, and he was talking with his hands. I noticed calluses on them, and a deep, long cut on the back of his left thumb. The scab looked new. I shook my head and said an adamant no, though deep down I knew I wasn't being entirely truthful. That was absolutely part of why I was here. I wanted him to know that I was a good person. At least I thought I was, and certainly not the type to offer bribes to get my way. No, I'm here to tell you that I think it should go forward to the Honor Council, I said softly. I think you should make sure that it does. He looked at me and shrugged.
Okay, fine. Noted. Is that all?
No, I said. Because there was something else, too. Another reason I was there. I'd made myself say it at my own peril. I'm also here to ask about Lila. How is she? A look of surprise crossed his face as he sat back a bit in his chair. Several seconds passed before he replied.
She's fine, he said.
What's she like? I said, preparing myself to be told off again. For him to tell me that was none of my business. But instead, he said,
She's a sweet kid, but tough.
I nodded, sensing I was about to be dismissed. Well, will you please tell her that I'm so sorry? He ran his hand over his stubble, then leaned forward, staring into my eyes.
Why are you sorry, Nina? Do you think you're to blame for what your son did?
I hesitated, thinking, and then replied, Yes, I do, actually, at least in part.
And why is that? He pressed.
Because, I said, I'm his mother. I should have taught him better. After leaving the East End and crossing back over the Woodland Street Bridge, I couldn't make myself go home. Instead, I wound my way through Lower Broadway, the heart of Nash Vegas, with all of its neon honky-tonks and juke joints that I hadn't been to since the last of my friend's bachelorettes. It was a shame we didn't come here more. I love live music at Roberts and Layla's and Tootsie's, but it really isn't Kirk's thing. Unless he's wasted, in which case it isn't my thing. I kept driving, all around downtown, eventually turning onto 6th Avenue, slowing as I passed the Hermitage. The same valet who had opened the Uber door for me the night of the Hope Gala was out in front again, and I found it almost impossible to believe
that it had been only 5 days since the incident. So much had changed since then. Or at least so much had been acknowledged in my own heart. My phone vibrated in my purse with an incoming call. I didn't check to see who it was as I drove around the capital, then up into Germantown. Realizing I was hungry, famished, I pulled into City House. It had been a long time since I'd eaten a meal alone in public, and it felt liberating to sit at the bar by myself. Not only did Kirk dictate where we went, but he always picked our table, too, and often ended up ordering for us. Why don't we split the beef tartare and a chop salad? And then we get the trout and the ribeye, he'd suggest, because those were his four favorites. Passivity wasn't the worst sin in the world, but I made a mental note to start making my own menu selections. Baby steps. At that moment, I went with a margarita pizza and a devil's harvest that the bartender brought in a can. He started to pour it into a glass, but I stopped him and said I'd do it, thank you. My phone vibrated again. This time I checked it, finding missed calls and texts from both Kirk and Finch, asking me where I was, when I'd be coming home, if I wanted to join them at Sperry's for an early dinner. I could tell they'd been communicating with each other, as their texts were worded so similarly, and I wondered what that meant. Was Kirk manipulating me? Or were they both just appropriately worried and upset? I wasn't sure. But I wrote them both back on a group thread, saying that I'd forgotten I had something and they should just go ahead without me. After finishing my pint and eating more pizza than I think I'd ever had in one sitting, I paid the bill and got back in my car. I drove aimlessly, headed toward the West End, ending up in Centennial Park, where Kirk and I used to take Finch, beginning when he was only a baby in a stroller. I tried to pinpoint my favorite stage of his life, our lives together, deciding that our best years were during middle elementary. Third and fourth grades, ages 8 and 9 or so, when Finch was old enough to really articulate his opinions and have interesting conversations with me, but still young enough to hold my hand in public. The halfway point of childhood. God, I miss those days so much. As I sat on the steps of the Parthenon, which housed the art museum where we used to stroll as a family, one memory rushed back to me. It was late fall, both of us wearing jackets, and I sat in a spot close to this one while Finch collected leaves pretending to make rutabaga and collard green stew. He'd learned the words from a children's song, the lyrics all coming back to me now. Victor Vito and Freddy Vasco ate a burrito with Tabasco. They put it on their rice, they put it on their beans, on their rutabagas, and on their collard greens. I thought of how much Finch had loved to sing and dance, how much he'd enjoyed music and art and cooking. Girly things, Kirk had called them, always worrying that I was making our son too soft. I told him that was ridiculous. But at some point, I caved to my husband's wishes, allowing Finch's free time to be filled with more mainstream boy activities. Sports and technology, Kirk's interests, replaced music and art, mine. I was fine with that. I just wanted our son to be true to himself. But with hindsight, I had the feeling that he was following in his father's footsteps. In all ways. Maybe it was an oversimplification, as I knew a person isn't the sum of his hobbies, but I couldn't help feeling that I had lost my son. Lost both of them. I longed to go back, do things differently, give Finch fewer material possessions and more of my time. I would have tried harder to keep talking to him, even when he no longer wanted me to. I thought back to my own timeline, the uptick of my philanthropic work, and all the socializing in those same circles that began a few years ago. How that swirl of activity happened to coincide with both the sale of Kirk's company and the onset of Finch's teenage years. It was hard to say which had happened first, but I wasn't blameless.
I thought about the hours I spent on the trivial things that had become so integral to my life. Meetings and parties and beauty appointments and workouts and tennis games and lunches and, yes,